This is an ABC podcast.
Updating your Facebook status, posting your family photos to Instagram, tracking your steps on your smartwatch, installing an app on your phone, sending an email, getting a snack from your smart fridge, scanning your loyalty card at the supermarket. Every day, we willingly hand out private information about ourselves and others to large corporations, organizations, and governments who track it, control it, and sell it. We know this is happening, and we know we should probably be more careful. But we like using social media. We like the supermarket discounts, and we find the tracking on our kids' smartphones and watches convenient and safe. This is the privacy paradox. So do we have a choice? Is privacy really possible now and in the future? I'm Edwina Stott, and this is Future Tense. Most of us are aware when we're exposing our data or giving away our information, but we could be revealing more than we think, and not just about ourselves.
So sharenting is often used to refer to the way that parents share on social media. And while this is a really big part of sharenting, it is not the only way that sharenting takes place. I think that sharenting is broader in two ways. One is that I think sharenting is not just parents. It's any adult in a child's life who is engaged in this behavior. And second, I include this behavior to mean not just social media, but anything digital. So that could be a smartwatch, that could be a smart refrigerator, that could be an educational technology app that a kid uses in school.
Leah Plunkett is an associate professor and associate dean at the University of New Hampshire, Franklin Pierce School of Law, and she's the author of Sharenthood.
We do not have a transparent, reliable way to determine what either an individual company, like let's say the manufacturer of that smart refrigerator, or what those companies' affiliates or partners might be gathering in terms of data, or what they're doing with it, to store it, to analyze it, or to engage in other activities with it.
And some of this information can even start being collected before the child's even born, isn't that right? With things like fertility apps or uploading scans of your baby, that kind of thing.
I think it's fascinating, Edwina, that the United States Supreme Court has declined so far to weigh in on when life begins. They've said in some famous cases that those questions are beyond the scope of the law, of the court. But yet we have technology companies that are rushing in where even the United States Supreme Court fears to tread. So whether it's a fertility app that tracks your menstrual cycle and may even nudge your partner about the best time of the month to deliver flowers or chocolate, or other products, we are giving companies digital information about the path to conceiving our children. And one paper, I believe it was the Washington Post, ran a very interesting story over the summer about the pregnancy tracking app Ovia. And the Washington Post ran a story saying that Ovia was giving some employers access to data about their employees, which I just found fascinating.
Considering the vast scope of information that is being given to these organizations and these companies about our children or children that we care for or have a relationship with, what does that mean for the children and their future?
It means that we adults are often unconsciously and generally with the best of intentions, regularly and systematically violating our kids' privacy. And that's problematic in a number of ways. One way is that we are exposing them to risks from criminal actors. We are also exposing them to actors, and those can be now or in the future, who may well aggregate, analyze, and use their data in ways we don't anticipate, can't control, and might not want. So an example of that would be, I currently have a preschooler. I'm comfortable sharing that information. And I really am scared that by the time my preschooler is ready to apply to college, apply for a job, get a house, apply for life insurance, that there will be vast volumes of digital data about them that will be used by gatekeepers to make decisions about their fitness for a given opportunity or a given product. And last and certainly not least, I really believe that we are eroding our children's individual experience of their own childhood. We're depriving them of a protected space to make mischief and even make mistakes and learn from them. And if you look at children as a whole, we are really changing the notion of what it means to be a child or an adolescent away from a time that is more protected and more private, where you get to kind of experiment and play, to a period of life that is tracked and preserved and potentially and likely, I should say, can come back to haunt them later in life.
So, in the interest of our children's privacy now and the implications that it may have in the future, what should we do? What's the solution?
I think the first solution is to do exactly what you and I and your listeners are doing now and have conversations. There is a lack of open and regular dialogue among adults about how we need to take responsibility for making value-based decisions about sharenting. We adults spend a fair amount of time thinking about how we teach our children not to be cyber bullies. We teach our children not to sext naked pictures of each other. We're very focused on what our kids should do or not do. We are just not talking in a sustained way about what we should do or not do. So the first is have conversations. The second is I really encourage every family, every school, every institution that has children under their control and custody to have a digital privacy plan and to think about the values and the rules of thumb that you want to have in play. One easy way for grown-ups to start thinking about this is to ask themselves, if they were born in the pre-digital era, before you share that piece of information on social media, ask yourself how you would have felt if your parents had done the equivalent to you. So, to give you a concrete example, if you are thinking about posting a Halloween picture, let's say that holiday is coming up. All the kids are super cute. We even dress up our dog. We turn him into a pumpkin. He hates it, but we think he's really cute. Before I were to share those pictures on social media, I really should be thinking to myself, gosh, if my parents, when I was 5 years old or 10 years old, whatever the age, had taken Halloween pictures of me and placed an ad in our local hard copy newspaper that, you know, had my picture and my name and said something about me, and that went out to everyone in town to look at, would I have thought that was okay, or would I have thought it was creepy? And I think the answer for me is I would have thought it was creepy. So then I shouldn't do the same thing to my children, even though it is easier to do now than it was in the brick and mortar era.
That's Associate Professor Leah Plunkett, author of Sharenthood. Thanks to social media, the internet, smartphones, and wearable tech, we're sharing more than ever before. And as we just heard, not only about ourselves. So with the data that relates specifically to us, does it matter? We wear the watch, we use the website, we download the app. Surely this means we've made the choice. But do we really know what we've chosen and what the information we're sharing is being used for?
Some of these companies are actually selling our personal data or using it to add value to their company, which they can later sell as a whole along with our personal information. But a lot of companies make their profit by using our personal data to sell ads. last year, Facebook made $55 billion in ad revenue, and Google made $116 billion in ad revenue. What we need to understand about this is that to make those billions, these companies need to be able to predict our future behavior very accurately, because their profit depends on being able to predict when we're going to click.
That's Dr. Catherine Kemp, senior lecturer at the University of New South Wales Faculty of Law.
This business of prediction is so profitable for them that Microsoft scientists have said that even a 0.1% increase in the accuracy of prediction can make hundreds of millions of dollars in extra revenue for a company. So that means really that these companies have an enormous profit motive to collect as much personal data as they can get their hands on, even when that's not in our interests. And they've also then got an incentive to try and influence or alter our future behavior, because that's an even better way to be able to predict what we'll do next.
What information are these organizations looking for? And why is this information in particular so valuable?
There are really very few boundaries on the kind of information that the major digital platforms are seeking, given that they're selling advertising and they're selling advertising to the full range of companies. They want to be able to predict all of our interests, all of our weaknesses, our susceptibilities, our health concerns, our family relationship, our friendships, our points of influence. There are really no boundaries on the kinds of information that they would be interested in. Some of the information we actively provide as users, and sometimes you can see when you're handing over information, if you're completing your profile yourself, or you may be aware that when you're making a post online, that that information is not just going to your friends and your colleagues, but it's being shared more broadly. Other information is not as noticeably collected. Sometimes we're completely unaware of the collection of information. A lot of people are unaware that when they move off Facebook's homepage, off the site itself, and navigate on other websites, that they are being tracked there. Information about their use of those third-party websites is being sent back to Facebook. If, for example, there is a Facebook like button on that website, it doesn't matter whether you press on that button or not, information about you is being sent back to Facebook. Likewise, the ACCC has reported that it doesn't even matter whether you're a Facebook user or not, information is being sent back.
Dr. Kemp says that while we sign up and use these services and even agree to their terms and conditions, it's not necessarily a level playing field when it comes to protecting our information.
The studies have shown that it would take you 6 working weeks a year for the average consumer to read all of the privacy policies that apply to them. So for most working adults, that's an impossibility. Aside from that, the physical impossibility of actually reading them all, there's the real question of how useful it would be to read those privacy policies. The privacy policies under scrutiny often use language that we can't understand and often have no real meaning. Things like, we can share your personal information with our trusted partners or our affiliates, or we can use your information for marketing or efficiency purposes. What does that mean? The policies often also create the illusion that you can opt out or take control of your data, but it later turns out that your opting out was ineffective, or the process is so difficult and confusing that a lot of people fail to make it work, or the company simply goes on collecting your data against your interests.
So if you were to read them, and you did, on the off chance, you did understand them, would there be anything that you could do about it other than just not use the service or not use the website?
At the moment in Australia, your choices would be very limited, and that's because under our current privacy law, consent is very broadly defined. It includes implied consent. So just by using a website, you can be taken to have agreed to a privacy policy. And it doesn't prevent companies from bundling consents. And so by bundling consents, we mean that a company might say to you, you agree to us using your personal information to improve our services to you and to provide the services to you, as well as using your personal information for marketing and advertising and providing to all of these third parties. And you don't get to choose between those various uses. It's all or nothing, take it or leave it. We're not being provided with those options, even though the surveys show us that consumers really do want to be able to choose and to opt out of non-essential uses of our personal information.
One of the things that people talk about when they talk about privacy is that, you know, oh, well, I realize that all of these ads that come up on my Facebook feed or online are tailored. So, you know, I'm not susceptible to them. Is that way of thinking actually realistic or true?
I think there are a couple of misconceptions there, or a couple of problems with that approach. One is that saying I've got nothing to hide is often implicitly saying I'm in the fairly enviable position of having qualities that companies and governments generally regard as desirable. I come from the correct ethnic background. I have the right kind of education and credit history, the right income level, so that exposing my information will not do me any personal harm, and overlooks the fact that our decisions about privacy have an effect on our society as a whole, that the most vulnerable people will suffer the most from a general reduction in privacy, because the outcomes will be worse for them in terms of exclusion and discrimination. So we do need to look beyond ourselves if we think that our personal information would only look good for us. The other problem there is that we don't know yet what kind of details will be inferred from our personal information over time and into the future. It might seem safe at the moment to give access to your wearable device, to your Fitbit, to an insurance company or to some other kind of company, because you feel that all of that information could only be in your favor. But over time, that kind of biometric data can reveal important aspects of your health, potentially deteriorating health or diseases that wouldn't be to your favor in future. And we've got to be aware that the immediate disclosure, the immediate use of the information may seem fine for now, but doesn't give the full picture of how we're exposing ourselves into the future.
That's Dr. Catherine Kemp, Senior Lecturer at the University of New South Wales Faculty of Law. As Dr. Kemp described, there's a lot at stake when it comes to ensuring our privacy, and the future's uncertain when it comes to how these great swathes of information and data on our identity could be used in the future. Before you get your diary out and start clearing 6 weeks of your year to read all those privacy policies, though, there is another way.
Obfuscation is an idea that my colleague Helen Nissenbaum and I came up with to talk about a different approach for thinking about protecting our privacy online. We tend to think about privacy as keeping our data away, you know, keeping it to ourselves, not posting things, not sharing things, opting out of tools, doing without. And we wanted to suggest that there's another way to protect our useful data, which is to flood anything that takes data from us with lots of data, most of which isn't true.
Finn Brunton is an associate professor of media, culture and communication at New York University and the co-author of Obfuscation, a user's guide for privacy and protest.
So obfuscation is a way of thinking about the defense of personal privacy that's based on the idea that we can actually hide our tracks inside of a lot of other noisy activity instead of having to diminish the quality of our lives through like relinquishing tools in order to protect our privacy.
So how is it done? How can we obfuscate our digital lives online?
It's a really good question, because when we talk about it in terms of the book, it sounds like this kind of radical new idea. But in fact, in practical ways, we obfuscate all the time. The original basis for this idea was noticing the ways that people would do things like find ways, if they had like an intrusive questionnaire, that they had to answer all the questions, to answer all the questions with a huge volume of sort of unnecessary and superfluous data. For digital terms, we try to take this idea and then come up with different ways to approach it, some of which we do personally ourselves, and some of which we can do automatically through our devices, through software. So for instance, there's a variety of web plugins, which will do things like automatically search Google on your behalf for all kinds of random things at random times of day and bursts in ways that are very like the way humans use Google, except that it's your browser searching Google for Florida real estate and Alzheimer's medication and panda video and what have you, so that your actual searches, which are sometimes extremely personal and sometimes extremely pertinent to important issues in your life, will be impossible to tell from all of the rest of the searches that the system has done on your behalf. Likewise, we've seen some really brilliant work around things like having plugins for Facebook that simply choose all of the emotion buttons every single time in such a way that you can actually swamp or randomly choose buttons or other things along those lines, but in such a way that you can basically swamp Facebook's emotion and sentiment tracking system so that the actual personal meaning that you are attributing to things from your friends, your communications with them, aren't necessarily useful for data mining.
And there's another piece of software that Finn says advertisers in particular find infuriating.
Ad Nauseam is built on the same principle as some of these other obfuscation plugins that we've been talking about, where instead of trying to make ads completely disappear, instead of trying to somehow protect you from ads, it simply loads all of the ads in the background as you move around on the web, and it clicks on all of them. It transforms your web activity into what every advertiser would hope for, which is, you know, a flood of clickstream data that shows what people are looking at, except that it's happening automatically and it's happening to everything, which pushes the value of that data down to zero. And in some ways, that's the larger goal of obfuscation, identifying the ways in which invasions of privacy can be profitable and finding ways to make that very substance, that data, into something worthless. Obfuscation is a starting point for understanding that our data belongs to us, and that our data actually, it both makes us vulnerable in a lot of different ways, but it also helps to build systems that cause disproportionate harm to people far more vulnerable than we might be. It's a massive public crisis, and it's one that we talk a lot about, the business side of things, advertising and corporations. But obviously, the long-term implications for this have grave consequences for how we understand what it is to be a free citizen in a modern society.
According to Finn, obfuscation offers a fun and playful alternative to the ordinarily guilt-inducing approach to privacy.
There's this tremendous tension and paranoia and like weird moral burden around privacy, where it's like, well, are you encrypting things? You know, have you started encrypting your email? Did you forget the password for encrypting your email so you can never read any of it again? Do you have the right kind of password manager? Do you use the right, are you the sort of fool who uses social media to stay in touch with relatives and not, you know, miss every single party because you don't care about your privacy and so on? There's a lot of sternness and anxiety and moralizing judgment that goes into managing privacy, which is warranted, but it also makes it into something that I think at a certain point people get burned out on. You reach a kind of fatigue with the tension and the fear that always takes place around what meticulous privacy management should look like. So we started thinking, what could be a way of thinking about privacy that enabled it to be playful and tricksy and have an element of a prank to it, but also through those pranks and playfulness and tricksiness made it possible for us to say, we don't owe these companies accurate data.
So obfuscation, as you say, is a temporary fix. What needs to happen long term to ensure the protection of our privacy?
In my ideal world, I think we would have the same relationship to data, to the data that we produce and to our privacy around it, that we do towards things like cars and food. I actually, whenever I have to go on a long drive and I pass a car accident, bizarre as this sounds, it makes me happy because one of the things that you see is the passengers and the drivers standing around, you know, on their phones, maybe chatting with the police, because they survived, which they would not have just a few decades before. When we look at the personal automobile, we're looking at something where a lot of technological work happened, but it happened in relation to strict regulation and a great deal of public oversight so that they could design a technology which people could use with full confidence in its safety, such that even if they made a grievous mistake, chances were very high that they would be fine. That's the same spirit that I hope we see in the future towards the management of data and technologies using data. Like, these are systems that have tremendous capacity for good. The kinds of things that we can unlock in areas that range from public health to psychology, to the efficiency and optimization of everyday life through the widespread collection of detailed data. These are tremendous social goods.
So Finn, you're confident that in the future, giving away our entire privacy and allowing companies to read everything and know everything about us isn't just the price we have to pay to be able to use these services?
Absolutely not. The situation that we are in right now is only presented as inevitable by people who are in that line of work and want it to feel like the only way that things could possibly work. The idea that digital technology and the innovations that have come from it and the positive effects that it's had in our lives had to happen in return for giving up tons of data to, you know, both skeezy advertisers and often to governments that may or may not use that information in the right ways. All of that was just a historical accident. If you go back just a handful of decades, no one anticipated that advertising was going to end up being the industry that was going to break a lot of the ways that the web worked and was going to habituate us to the idea that nothing we could do would ever be really private and would create contexts where ordinary networked appliances like our phones that are supposed to be aiding us in our lives are instead being used, for example, in the United States for things like trying to identify illegal immigrants so they can be arrested and deported. The drift of data collection towards these very, very dangerous and nightmarish outcomes, that's a drift that is more or less just the result of, you know, random circumstances in industry, you know, good luck, bad luck, a couple of bad choices along the way. It doesn't have to be like this. It could all be very, very different. And I sincerely hope that it will.
That's Associate Professor Finn Brunton, co-author of Obfuscation, a User's Guide to Privacy and Protest. So perhaps the future of our privacy is slightly more optimistic than certain corporations would have you believe. It may be a while before we really understand the full implications and even benefits of sharing our data online. But while we wait, we can take control of some of our data. And who knows, we might just have a bit of fun doing it. I'm Edwina Stott, and this was Future Tense. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listener.